Chapter 4, The Myth of the Return Journey. The parable of the burning house gives us the metaphor of life as predicament or even as trap, but this is of course only one way of looking at it. Human existence is multifaceted, deep and mysterious, difficult to understand. Wonders are many, and none is more wonderful than man, chants the chorus in Sophocles' play Antigone. Throughout history, facets of the nature and purpose of human life have been reflected by symbols and similes, from which have arisen myths, legends, and stories, and these in turn have crystallized into epic poems, novels, dramas, and parables. The mystery of human life always having been the compelling preoccupation of humanity, the great works of ancient and modern literature which concern some aspect of human existence are read and reread even after hundreds and thousands of years. Some of these great works see human life in terms of conflict or even warfare. Homer's Iliad, for example, tells the story of the battle between the Greeks and the Trojans over Helen of Troy, a battle involving not just men and women, but even gods and goddesses. 200 or 300 years after the Iliad, another epic was written, perhaps not so eminent from a literary point of view, but very, very much longer, the Mahabharata. This was composed by the Indian poet and sage Vyasa, and gives an account of the battle between the Kauravas and their cousins the Pandavas for possession of their ancestral kingdom. Northern Europe produced the anonymous 8th century Anglo-Saxon epic Beowulf, which recounts the battles of the hero Beowulf against three terrible adversaries: the fiendish monster Grendel, Grendel's still more fiendish mother, and the dragon. Even from comparatively modern times, we have one of the very greatest of all epic poems, Milton's Paradise Lost, whose main theme is the war in heaven, the battle between Satan and the Messiah. In all these works, life is seen in terms of conflict. Life is a battle between right and wrong, between light and darkness, between heaven and hell, between conscious and unconscious, and the battleground is the human heart. But human existence can also be seen as a riddle, a mystery, or even a problem. And this is how the book of Job in the Bible sees it. Job has been brought up to believe that God rewards the good for their virtue and punishes the wicked, here in this very life. But although Job is conscious of no evil in himself, he suffers, and it seems that his suffering is the punishment of God. Why should the just man be ground into dust, while the unjust man flourishes like the green bay tree? To make sense of life, Job needs to know the answer. The same kind of question plagues Shakespeare's Hamlet, confronted with the murder of his innocent father by his villainous uncle. When Hamlet asks his famous question, "To be or not to be?" life itself has become a problem. There are many other ways of viewing human existence. However, of all the symbols and similes for life, perhaps the most popular and significant is that of the journey or pilgrimage. Life is not only a battle, not only a problem, it is a journey from the cradle to the grave, from innocence to experience, from the depths of existence to the heights, from darkness to light, from death to immortality. We find life seen as a journey in a great number of works: The Odyssey, The Divine Comedy, Monkey, Pilgrim's Progress, Wilhelm Meister, Peer Gynt, and countless others. The White Lotus Sutra gives its own account of human life as a journey. The parable of the return journey, which occurs in chapter 4, is related not by the Buddha, but by four great elders. They have heard the Buddha tell the assembly that Shariputra is now so far advanced on the path that he is sure to reach the highest goal of all, not just emancipation from his own individual sin and suffering, but Buddhahood itself. Amazed and delighted to learn that the spiritual life has a higher aim, the existence of which they had hitherto not suspected, the four great elders say they feel as though they have quite unexpectedly acquired a priceless jewel, and in chorus they give expression to their feelings in a parable. They say that once upon a time there was a man who left his father and went away into a distant country. He lived there for a long time, perhaps as long as 50 years, and during all that time he was miserably poor, roaming around, doing a job here and a job there. He lived from hand to mouth, and all he ever possessed were the clothes he stood up in. Meanwhile, his father was leading a very different kind of life. He was a businessman, and met with some such success in his various trading ventures that he became extremely rich. His trade took him from place to place, until he finally settled in another country, where he continued to heap up riches, gold, silver, jewels, and grain. He had slaves and workmen and journeymen, horses and carriages, cows and sheep. He even had elephants, and in the East, if you possess elephants, you really are rich. He also inevitably had dozens of dependents and followers clustering around him in the hope of some reward. His influence in business, money-lending, agriculture, commerce, spread far and wide, and he lived the life of a merchant prince. But despite his growing wealth and all his business activities, the rich man never stopped missing his son. How was the boy? Would they ever meet again? Sorrowful at their long separation, his one hope was that one day his son would come home to inherit the wealth due to him. After all, the rich man thought, I am getting old, and one day I must surely die. All this time the son continued to roam from one town to the next, from one kingdom to the next, until one day, quite by chance, he came to the place where his father was living, although of course he had no idea that he was anywhere near his father. As he was passing, or rather skulking through the streets, keeping a lookout for odd jobs which would earn him a few coppers for food, he saw an enormous house, and sitting in the doorway, he saw what seemed to be a very rich man. He was surrounded by an enormous company of people, all waiting on him, or waiting for him. Some had bills in their hands, and others had great bundles of money that they wanted to give him. Others had presents, or maybe some had bribes. The rich man was sitting in the gateway on a magnificent throne. Even his footstool was ornamented with gold and silver. He was handling millions of gold pieces, just running his fingers through them, and someone was standing behind him, fanning him with a yak's tail. In India, a yak's tail is one of the symbols of royalty and divinity, so you would only be fanned with one if you were very, very rich indeed, and had been exalted almost to the plane of divinity. Not only that, he was sitting under a magnificent silk canopy, which was inlaid with pearls and flowers, and hung all round with garlands of jewels. He really was a magnificent sight. When the poor man saw this rich man seated there on his throne, in all this state, he was absolutely terrified. He thought he must have come upon the king, or at the very least, some great nobleman. I'd better be off, he said to himself. I'm much more likely to get work in the streets of the poor. If I stay here, they might make me into a slave. And he hurried away, without the faintest idea that the rich man was his own father. But the rich merchant no sooner saw that wretchedly poor man at the edge of the crowd of followers than he knew that this was his son, come back after all these years. What a relief! Now he will be able to hand over his wealth to its rightful inheritor and die happy. Joyfully he called a couple of servants and told them to run after the poor man and bring him back. But when they caught up with the poor fellow, he was more terrified than ever. They've been sent to arrest me. I'm probably going to have my head cut off, he thought, and he was so afraid that he fell to the earth in a dead faint. His father was rather surprised at this, but he began to see that all those years he had been living in riches, his son had been living in poverty, and this had created a great psychological difference between them. The boy was obviously not used to being in contact with the rich and the powerful. But the faithful father thought, never mind, however low he may have sunk, he is still my son. And he resolved to find a way of restoring their relationship. In the meantime, things being as they were, he decided that it would be better to keep his son's identity secret. He therefore called another servant and instructed him to tell the poor man that he was free to go. Hardly believing his luck, the poor man went off with all speed to seek work in the poorest quarter of the town. But he was followed by two of his father's men, chosen for their humble appearance. When they caught up with him, the men offered him work, as the rich man had instructed them to do. The job would be to clear away a huge heap of dirt that had accumulated at the back of the mansion, and the wages would be double the normal rate. The poor man accepted this proposal at once, and went off to work with the two men. Day after day he shovelled the heap of dirt, and removed it in baskets to a distant place. He found lodging in a straw hovel right next to the mansion, so close that the rich man could see it from his window. The rich man would often look out and think how strange it was that he should be living in a beautiful mansion while his son lived in squalor so nearby. One day, when the poor man had been working at the mansion for quite some time, the rich man put on dirty clothes and, taking a basket in his hands, managed to have a talk with his son. "Don't think of working anywhere else," he says. "I'll make sure you've got plenty of money. If there's anything you need, a pot, a jug, some extra grain, anything like that, just ask me. I've got an old cloak in the cupboard. You can have that if you like. Don't worry about a thing. You've been working well, and I'm pleased with you. You seem honest and sincere, not like some of the rogues I've got working for me. In fact, well, I'm an old man. You look to me as your own father, and I'll treat you just like my own son." So for a number of years the poor man carried on clearing away the heap of dirt, and he got into the habit of going in and out of the mansion without thinking twice, although he continued to live in his old straw hovel. Then it happened that the old man became ill, and he knew that he was soon going to die. He called the poor man and said, "I feel that I can trust you completely now, just as I would my own son, so I'm going to hand over to you the management of all my affairs. You'll do everything on my behalf." And from that day onward, the poor man was the rich man's steward and looked after all his investments and transactions. As before, he went freely in and out of the mansion, but continued to live in his old hovel. Even though he was handling all this wealth, he continued to think that he was poor, for as far as he knew, the money was not his, but his master's. But as time went on, the poor man changed. His father, who watched him constantly, saw that he was gradually becoming accustomed to handling riches, and feeling ashamed that in the past he had lived so miserably. It became obvious that the poor man had begun to want to be rich himself. By this time the rich man was very old and weak indeed, and he knew that his death was near. So he sent for all the people in the city, the king's representative, the merchants, his friends, his distant relations, ordinary citizens, and country folk from round about. And when they were all gathered, he presented his son to them and told them the whole story. When he had finished, he handed over all his wealth to his son, who, of course, could hardly believe his good fortune. In the context of the White Lotus Sutra, this parable has a specific meaning which the four elders explain as soon as they have finished telling the story. Until now, they confess, they have been contented with an inferior spiritual ideal. But now, in his kindness and generosity, the Buddha has revealed to them the ideal of attaining supreme enlightenment, not for themselves alone, but for the benefit of all sentient beings, and in this way has made them heirs to all his spiritual treasures. Like the son in the parable, the four elders feel overjoyed at the wealth which they have so unexpectedly gained. The four elders' explanation takes us quite a long way, but with a little imagination, we can go much further, even much deeper. We can start by reflecting on the strangely familiar ring of this story. You may well be thinking, I'm sure I've heard that story somewhere before. Thinking back, you may be pretty sure that you haven't read the White Lotus Sutra. It isn't the sort of thing you can read one weekend and then forget about. So why does the parable of the return journey seem so familiar? The reason, as you may have realized, is that it resembles a much more widely known parable, Jesus' parable of the prodigal son. This parable is told by Jesus of Nazareth to elucidate a different point, and it has a different ending, but in general outline the two stories are the same. In both parables, there is an affectionate father and a son who runs away. In both parables, the runaway son lives miserably for a while before returning to the bosom of his father. And in both parables, the position of servant is contrasted with the position of son. These are the similarities between the parables. There are also significant differences between them. Perhaps the most important of these differences is that in the gospel parable, the prodigal son appears to be guilty of willful disobedience, whereas in the White Lotus Sutra, the son seems to go astray just through carelessness and forgetfulness. This illustrates a crucial difference between Buddhism and Christianity. Christianity seeing the human condition in terms of sin, disobedience and guilt, while Buddhism sees it more in terms of forgetfulness, unmindfulness and ignorance. Another parable about a father and a son, belonging to roughly the same period as the parable of the return journey, constitutes an even more interesting parallel. It occurs in the apocryphal Acts of the Apostle Thomas, an essentially Gnostic work, extant in Greek translation as well as in the original Syriac. Modern translators call the story the Hymn of the Pearl, but the text gives it the title Song of the Apostle Judas Thomas in the Land of the Indians. Saint Thomas, one of the 12 apostles, is traditionally known as the Apostle to India, because he is supposed to have visited India soon after the death of Jesus. And this parable is said to have been composed while he was imprisoned there. Whether he had much contact with Buddhism, and whether the Hymn of the Pearl owes anything to the parable of the return journey, we can only speculate. The parable says that in the East there live a father and his son. The son is quite happy living in the wealth and splendour of the kingdom of his father's house. But one day his father sends him on a mission to the land of Egypt to bring back the one pearl which lies encircled by a great dragon in the midst of the sea. When he reaches Egypt, the son finds the dragon and waits for him to go to sleep so that he can take the pearl. But the Egyptians become suspicious of this stranger, even though he is disguised in Egyptian garments, and they give him a drugged drink which causes him to lose his memory. Forgetting that he is the son of a king, forgetting all about the pearl, he enters the service of the king of Egypt. And eventually, living with the Egyptians, eating their food and drinking their drink, he becomes more and more like them. In the end, we are told, he falls into a deep sleep. His father in the East, who knows what is happening, becomes anxious and sends his son a letter in the form of a bird, reminding him of his mission. And as soon as he receives the letter, the son comes to his senses, enchants the dragon, and seizes the pearl. He returns home in triumph, and his father receives him with great joy. Each of these parables, the return journey, the prodigal son, and the hymn of the pearl, has its own wealth of symbolism, but they all share the same central symbol, They all begin with a separation between a father and a son. This is the event from which everything else follows. So what is meant by this separation of father and son? Who or what are the father and the son? We could say that the father represents what may be called the higher self, although we need to be careful not to take this expression too literally, and the son is the lower self. And just as the son is separated from his father, the lower self is separated, or in more contemporary language, alienated from the higher self. Here, by the way, is another metaphor for the human condition, alienation. We are alienated from our own higher selves, our own better natures, and our own highest potentialities. We are alienated from truth, from reality. And just as the son went not just a short distance away from his father, but to an altogether different part of the world, so the alienation between the higher self and the lower self is severe. Indeed, the schism between the two is complete. There is no contact of any kind between them. We may say that the condition of the human race is one of alienation from truth, but when did this condition begin? The son lives in a distant country for many years, which suggests that the alienation is of long standing. But if we take the parable literally, the implication is that although it may have happened a long time ago, it did happen at a certain point in time. This is the view of Orthodox Christianity, which teaches that Adam and Eve lived happily in the Garden of Eden, in harmony with God and in obedience with his commands, until Adam took a bite of the apple, at which point mankind fell from grace and became alienated from God. Buddhism holds a different view. According to the Buddha, you can go back and back in time for millions of years, millions of ages, but you will never come to an absolute first beginning of things. However far back you go, you can still go further. You will never get back to a point before the point at which time begins. So the beginning of the parable is not in time at all, but completely outside time. This means that the return journey is not a journey back into the past, but a journey out of time altogether, a journey which transcends time. It is very important to understand this. In the books about Zen, which people are so fond of reading, there are all kinds of strange and wonderful, and apparently meaningful, expressions, all kinds of appealingly snappy little mondos and koans. One of these Zen sayings, which is of course absolutely true, speaks of your original face before you were born. Zen masters are apparently fond of asking their disciples, at a moment's notice, to show them their original face before they were born. Come on, they demand. Show it to me. I want to see it. Of course, the hapless disciple usually fails miserably, as hapless disciples tend to do in these stories, written as they apparently are by the masters. The disciple tends to tackle the problem by sitting down and thinking about yesterday, the day before, a week before, a month ago, 2 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, until they get back to the day they were born. If they can then get past that, they think, they will encounter their original face. This is all wrong. To think that before a certain point in time there was the original face, and after that there was no original face, is a complete misunderstanding. The expression may seem to mean this, but if we go trying to track down the original face in the past, if we take this expression original, or the word before, literally, we are not really practicing Zen, but just regressing in the psychoanalytical sense. The past is no nearer to enlightenment than the present or the future, because time has nothing to do with enlightenment. We are born, in the Zen sense, out of time, and our original face also exists out of time. So the Zen expression, seeing your original face, has nothing to do with going back in time, or with going forward in time, or with standing still in the present moment of time. When Zen speaks of seeing your original face before you were born, it means going outside time altogether, rocketing through time and coming up on the other side in a dimension where there is no time at all, no past, present or future. This is where the original face is to be seen and nowhere else. That's where it is all the time. So there is no question of going back in time to inquire into the beginning of our state of alienation. We are alienated from reality here and now, and all we have to do is overcome this alienation from reality. And we can't just do that by going back and back into the past, because we are still running on the rails of the alienation itself. We have to take a leap, a crosswise leap, a jump from the top of the pole, to use another Zen expression, to land, if we're lucky, in the absolute. This is the point of the Buddha's famous parable of the poisoned arrow, another parable connected with war, which is told in the Pali Canon. The Buddha says that a soldier was wounded in battle by a poisoned arrow. Fortunately, there is a surgeon on hand, but when he tries to take the arrow out, the wounded man says, "Just a minute. Before I let you take out that arrow, I want to ask a few questions. Who shot this arrow? Was he a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, or a Vaishya? Was he dark or fair? Was he young or old? What sort of bow was he using? And what sort of arrow is it? A wooden one? An iron one? If it's wood, what sort of wood is it made from? Oak? Cedar? And where does the feather come from? Is it a goose feather or a peacock feather? Answer all these questions, and then you can take out the arrow." Long before his questions were answered, of course, the soldier would be dead from the poison in the arrow. The important thing is to get rid of the arrow, not to inquire where it came from. In the same way, if we try to go back and back all the time, how did the world begin? How did we get into such a mess? What was I in my last birth? What are the roots of my neurosis? There is no end to it. We could go step by step back into the past and still be walking in millions of years. What we need to do is just see our present alienated, neurotic, conditioned, negative state and rise above it, go soaring up into eternity, into a spiritual dimension. This is the message of the poisoned arrow. Likewise, the return journey of the sun is not about going back in time, but about going beyond time. The sun, who represents the lower self, wanders from place to place looking for work, for the simple reason that he needs food and clothing. He has no higher ideals. He has none of his father's ambitions of succeeding in trade and commerce. Translating this into modern terms, borrowed from Abraham Maslow's book Towards the Psychology of Being, the lower self is need-motivated. Everything the son does is out of his subjective need, out of his craving. By contrast, the father, the higher self, is growth-motivated. The parable expresses this in terms of his accumulation of riches, but this is in no way to imply that it is glorifying capitalism or anything like that. As a parable, its meaning is symbolic. The father, the higher self, accumulates wealth until he possesses all conceivable spiritual riches and qualities. Although he is so rich, the father is not happy, because he is thinking of his son all the time. What can we infer from this? It tells us that the higher self never loses its awareness. It's conscious all the time. Although we may completely forget the higher self never forgets us. But at the same time, this is the mystery, we are it. An image may help to make this clear. Imagine an enormous subterranean chamber all lit up from within. We are living in a tiny chamber next to, indeed part of, the big one. A pane of glass which is transparent only from one side separates the two chambers, so that although someone in the large illuminated chamber could see everything going on in the little chamber, From the little chamber, we can see nothing at all of what is going on in the large chamber. In fact, we have no idea that there is a large chamber. But although cramped in a little chamber, we may forget, even be oblivious to, the existence of the large chamber, the large chamber always has a window onto the little chamber. Even though the lower self forgets the higher self is the higher self of the lower self. The parable says that the poor man roams from one town to another and one country to another until he eventually reaches the place where his father is living. So he is already on his way back to his father, although he does not know it. It is his need for food and clothing, his craving, which drives him from place to place and brings him almost to his father's door. What are we to make of this? Let's look at an example. A man has a certain psychological problem. He's so worried about it that he just can't sleep, and sleeping tablets don't help. He is really getting desperate for some peace of mind. One day he meets a friend who says, "I know what will help you. You need to meditate." By this stage, the man is ready to try anything, so he asks where he can learn to meditate and goes along to a class. His only concern is to get rid of the problem and get some sleep. But at the meditation classes, he starts to hear about something new, Buddhism. At first he is not particularly interested, but after a few months, rather to his surprise, he finds himself not just trying to get peace of mind, but trying to follow the spiritual path. After a while, he even starts thinking in terms of enlightenment. So when did he take the first step in that direction? It was when, driven by his need for peace of mind, he joined the meditation class. In the same way, the poor man, driven by his basic needs, made his way to his father's door without knowing it. This is the first stage of the return journey. When the poor man eventually arrives at his father's door, his father is sitting outside, surrounded by gold, jewels, and flowers. The poetic description of the rich man, who represents the higher self, is highly significant. He is a glorious archetypal figure, a god, even a Buddha, so he is described with light and colour, jewels and brilliance. But how does the poor man react? He is so terrified at the sight that he wants to run away. He thinks that he has come upon a king or nobleman, not recognizing in this glorious figure his own father. This goes to show that the alienation between the lower self and the higher self is quite severe. Even when the two confront each other, the lower self does not recognize the higher self as its own higher self, but thinks it is something strange and foreign. Such a confrontation occurs when we come face to face with an embodiment of the spiritual ideal. Whenever we read a description or see an image of the Buddha, or some god or saint, we think, or our lower self thinks, "This has nothing to do with me. I'm down here, poor and humble. I'm not like that. I don't have those qualities." The theistic systems which believe in a personal creator god, and indeed all dualistic systems, encourage this attitude. We could call this stage the stage of religious projection. We project outwards all the qualities which are buried deep down in the depths of our own nature, not realizing that they are our own. As we see it, these glorious external figures are endowed with all the qualities which we lack. We are poor and they are rich. This religious projection is a step in the right direction. Indeed, it is the next stage of the journey. It is a positive thing because it enables us to see spiritual qualities in a concrete way. But the projection must be resolved. These qualities belong to us, not to our ego, but to the deepest and truest depths of our own being, and we must claim them as our own. As yet, however, the son does not recognize his father, although his father immediately recognizes him and sends messages to bring him back. But the poor man is terrified, thinks he is going to be executed, arrested, and faints away. This reminds me of the account of the death experience given in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. At the time of death, so the text says, the clear light, a white light of absolutely unbearable brilliance, like a million suns, suddenly bursts on the vision of the dying person. This light is the light of reality, the light of truth, the light of the void. If we recognize that this is no light bursting upon us from without, but the light of our own intrinsic mind, our own true self, unfolding from deep within, if we can realize our oneness with that light, then we gain enlightenment on the spot. But what happens? The light comes, blinding, terrible, overpowering, and most dying people shrink back in fear. Humankind cannot bear very much reality, as T.S. Eliot said. This is true not only at the moment of death, but at all those moments when we encounter a truth that seems more than we can possibly bear. The poor man, you notice, is not just terrified. His imagination is working overtime. He thinks that he is being arrested. Already in his mind's eye he can see the block and the executioner's axe. His first thoughts are of imprisonment, slavery, violent death. Only too often when we come in contact with the truth, it seems not liberating, but an imprisonment, a limitation, or at least a nuisance. We do not want to change our ideas, or to change ourselves, and in that diseased state, the liberating truth seems to us confining and narrow. Not only that, like the poor man in the parable, we are afraid of dying. When the lower self, the I, the ego, comes in contact with reality, it thinks, as it were, I'm for the chop, I'm finished, this is the end of me, and so it shrinks back. So the rich man lets his son slope off, but of course he has not given up hope, and by some clever planning he manages to get his son clearing away the heap of dirt at the back of his mansion. Now, according to the interpretation of the parable which the four elders give, the son's clearing away dirt represents the narrow, selfish type of religious life which is aimed at individual development to the exclusion of any concern for others. The four elders identify this sort of approach with the Hinayana, the lesser teaching which they have so recently renounced, but this is perhaps a little extreme. A better, or at least more contemporary, interpretation would suggest that the clearing away of the dirt represents the process of psychoanalysis, the heap of dirt representing all the repressions which the alienated person uncovers during analysis. The sutra mentions that it takes 20 years to clear away the dirt, which seems rather a long time, but resolving repressions, negative emotions, complexes, and all the rest of it, is rather time-consuming, so analysis does sometimes take as long as that. And eventually, while the process of removing the dirt heap continues, the father manages to speak to his son, and confidence springs up between them. As this trust develops, the poor man begins to enter the rich man's mansion without hesitation, but he continues to live in his own hovel. So what does this mean? On one level it refers to the scholar, the academic specialist in comparative religion. He knows the texts, sometimes in the original languages, and he knows the teachings, even the higher teachings. Sometimes he even claims to know the esoteric teachings. In other words, he goes in and out of the mansion without hesitation, knowing exactly what is there, but he does not live there himself. He still lives in the straw hovel, which represents all the things he is really interested in as an academic. Promotion within his department, his annual increment, prestige within his profession, controversy and brisk exchange of articles and opinions with other scholars. On a higher level, the poor man's going in and out of the mansion, without hesitation, refers to the average follower of religion. Such people are undoubtedly sincere and have had, perhaps, genuine religious experience. They go in and out of the mansion, as it were, but their home is elsewhere. Even though they have had some spiritual experience, maybe during the weekly meditation class, They are preoccupied most of the time with mundane things. In one of his books, William James, the great psychologist and author of The Varieties of Religious Experience, discusses the question, what is a religious person? He says that a religious person is not one who has religious experiences, anybody can have those, but one who makes religious experiences the centre of their existence. It is not important where we visit, what is important is where we permanently live, or at least where we live most of the time. In other words, where our real centre of interest lies. As the Gospel says, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. When the rich man falls sick, he hands the management of his affairs over to the poor man, who thus becomes familiar with riches, but still continues to live in the hovel. This element of the parable represents the theist, or the theistically inclined mystic, and the dualistic approach in general. Such a person may have great, overwhelming, uplifting spiritual experiences, but they all seem to come from outside, not from within. The mystic says, "These experiences are not mine, they are the gifts of God." Once you reach this stage of the journey, only time is required. The rich man sees that his son is becoming used to riches and ashamed of his poverty, that he aspires to be rich himself. In other words, the alienation of lower self from higher self is becoming less and less. When the rich man is at the point of death, the alienation is practically over, with just a thin thread remaining. The lower self and the higher self are almost one. And when at last the rich man acknowledges the poor man as his son, he dies, and there are no longer two, father and son, rich man and poor man, but only one, a rich man who was once a poor man. In other words, unity between the lower self and the higher self has been completely restored. The return journey has been accomplished. Our journey also is nearly accomplished. The four elders who have told the parable compare themselves to the son, and the Buddha, of course, is the father. Formerly, they say, they had not dared to think in terms of becoming like the Buddha, thinking only of following his verbal teaching, which had seemed to indicate a lesser goal, the goal of individual emancipation, the goal of the destruction of negative emotions. But they now realize, they say, that that is not enough, for there are all sorts of positive qualities to be developed. It is not enough to have wisdom, you need compassion too. It is not enough to be an arhat, you can become like the Buddha himself. You can follow the Bodhisattva path, you can aspire to supreme enlightenment. In other words, the four elders wake up to the truth of the higher evolution of man. They realize that the Buddha is not something unique and unrepeatable, but a forerunner, an example of what others too can become, if only they make the effort. They realize that the religious life is not just a personal affair in a negative, limited sense, but part of a cosmic adventure. And this is what we too have to try to realize. Religion, when properly understood, is not something remote from life, not just a dull, churchy little backwater, but life become conscious of its own upward tendency, its own tendency to grow and develop. And whether we know it or not, we are all involved, directly or indirectly, in this upward tendency of life. Each one of us is the poor man in the parable, the son who has run away. But each one of us also, if we only knew it, is the rich man, the father. And each one of us is making, even at this very moment, the return journey.